and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre, and this show is for early April 2023. At the time we're recording, the global carbon dioxide level is at 422.74 parts per million, which, dear listener, is 72.74 parts per million above the 350 parts per million that scientists tell us is where we ought to be. On top of that, there are only 2,464 days left until the year 2030, by which time we must cut our carbon emissions in half. So, lots to do. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I am doing well, and I'm very excited to be talking to Justin Bean today about his new book, and he'll give us a roadmap that'll help us envision a sustainable and thriving world.
So climate activists spend a lot of time doing the equivalent of that famous painting in Norway of the Scream, right? Where we have our hands on our face saying, oh my God, everything's terrible, everything's terrible. There's a school of thought that says, there's a business aphorism that says you cannot manage what you don't measure. And there's also a related thing that says you cannot build something that you cannot envision or imagine. So if we want to talk about the future, we have to be able to talk about what it's going to look like. Right. And so that's an important skill for climate activists. Well, if you want to think about how to not just do sort of an Alvin Toffler, you know, visions of the future kind of thing, but actually think about how would you go about building a future, you need to take some care and some thought. And so we are fortunate to have with us today somebody who wrote the book about how to envision futures. It's a book entitled, and I've got the title here, it's called What Could Go Right? And the author is Justin Bean, who is a remarkable guy. He's a sustainability strategist, but he's also an author. He's a Silicon Valley kind of guy and actually dabbles in angel investing. My goodness. Whatever that is, maybe you can tell us what that is. He's also got an MBA, and he's a sociologist. So, as they used to say, a Renaissance man who has lots of different perspectives. And that is reflective of his book, which covers a lot of different aspects of what it means to think about the future. So, with that ado, Justin, welcome to our show.
Ted, Mariah, thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. So. The title of your book is What Could Go Right? And it's about envisioning the world that we want to build. And so tell me, explain that a little bit more. What do you mean when you say we need to think about it, we need to consciously envision a new world?
Yeah. As a fellow climate activist, I think it's really difficult to get out of this sort of doomerism and doom and gloom feelings about the world around us today and about the future. And it's well-founded. There's a lot of climate research that is very scary and happening very quickly. And we face some really significant challenges. And so this book is not about belittling those challenges. We face enormous social, environmental, and economic challenges ahead of us. But if we really care to do something about it, the worst thing that we can do is to submit to that doom and gloom and these dystopian views of the future and become apathetic and not do anything about it. If we really care about the future and we really want to build a better one for ourselves and for our children, then what we need to do is envision what that better future is that we want to live in, which changes our mindset from fear and cynicism and all of that doom and gloom that gets a hold of us. And instead, we're able to get excited about something that we really want and we actually desire to live in. And not only that, but it gives us something to build and something to work towards. So if we're able to create a vision of what that future is, we can then create a roadmap and say, what are the steps that it's going to take to reach that future? And then I can break those steps into little pieces and then start getting busy on it. Whether that means, you know, I build an organization or I work for a company or I build a startup or I work on policy, whatever my role to play is in building this future, having that goal at the end of the day is what gives me a path to walk down and to work towards. So that was the sort of general concept of how we need to make this mindset shift and go from, you know, stories of a dystopian future, which is basically all we see around us, right? When I looked for stories of the future, what did I find? I found Terminator, Black Mirror, right? Independence, like all of these really entertaining stories, but painting pictures of a world that no one in their right mind would want to live in, and cautionary tales, fair enough, that tell us we shouldn't let AI take over the world, especially as, you know, killer robots, fair enough. But once the killer robots are, you know, staved off, what then? What do we want to do with our time? What kind of world do we actually want to live in once it's safe?
I was intrigued. I mean, you spent some time discussing an attitude of cynicism that people might have. And I think that's a fair thing to do because it creeps into the way you envision the world, even if you don't think you're a cynic. But I mean, most of the time you are sort of linearly extrapolating the bad things that you know about. And that's kind of facile and easy to do, right? Right. Yeah. AI is going to eat our lunch, right? Yeah. Along with everything else, right? Without the harder work of, as you say. So here's a question for you. A few years ago, something called the Green New Deal was much more in the news, right? The Inflation Reduction Act has sort of co-opted some of that. But there was a great video that what's her name? Octavia AOC.
Oh, yeah, Ocasio-Cortez.
And it was just this beautiful thing about how, you know, a positive image of the future. And I guess the question is that, tell me, I think that in your book, you're much bigger than sort of a cartoon vision of spandex jackets for everyone, right? You are constructing a more, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in your book that is talks about Maslow's hierarchies and, okay, so tell me, what's the scale at which, in your mind, you're envisioning the future?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think there are so many scales that we need to envision. But first, on the pessimism point, right, we kind of get in this mode of like, we can predict the future and we can go from being pessimistic about what will happen to, you know, being a Pollyanna optimist, right? And just positive thinking and that'll do it. So we need to transcend that spectrum and instead envision the future we want so that we can build it. And so at what scale? I really enjoy big picture thinking. As you mentioned, I studied sociology. I've always thought in these like societal, you know, 1,000-year scales, what does humanity do and where do we go from here? And so for me, that's a lot of fun. And I think it's also helpful for us to share that macro vision of the world that we really want to live in, because not only can we break it into those steps for a roadmap to build it, we can break it into parts and then say, okay, I'm a small business owner. And I'm looking at it from, I want to have an impact, but I also need to feed my family. Guess what? Sustainable products and services markets are growing much faster than conventional markets. Companies and corporations that incorporate sustainability and social impact into their core business actually have better revenues, higher margins, lower costs of capital. They retain talent better and recruit easier. So there's all these sort of peripheral benefits to building out this sustainable future, and ones that don't only require a government mandate. So I think the Green New Deal is awesome. I think the infrastructure bill is great, and it's putting some really big tailwinds behind a lot of the sustainable energy markets and rebuilding the infrastructure that we need in America, and setting a good example for others around the world to, you know, put public funds into building that better future. And so that's a big part of it. So government plays a role for sure. But I think what we're also seeing is a shift from thinking that it's on the shoulders of the government to do all the work. And now it's becoming feasible and viable for corporations and for startups to go out and actually build the solutions that get us there. So, you know, I'll share a story of you know, something that kind of hit me one time as an epiphany. So I lived in Japan for about 5 years. I taught English after undergrad and worked at a semiconductor company out there for a bit. And so I lived in downtown Osaka. And if you've seen pictures of Osaka, you've probably seen the Glico Man and a bridge across the Dotonbori River surrounded by neon signs. And it's all neon signs. They're lighting up the water. And it's this beautiful spectacle. And so I was walking home one night and crossed through there thinking about, what's my next step? What do I want to do with my career? And how can I make an impact to help us get through these environmental challenges and social challenges? And I looked around me and I realized that every one of those neon signs was advertising a business. And every one of those little stalls that I was walking by was a business. And every, you know, every place that I interacted with other people, the vast majority were businesses. So government has a role to play in setting those kind of rules of the game and all of that. But really, if you want to have an impact on the world and you want to make it at the scale that it needs to happen, 80%+ of human activity is done by businesses, corporations. So if you can convert that part of our economy into one that's sustainable, ethical, equitable, all of that, then you've won the future. And so that's why, you know, went forward into getting a sustainability MBA and getting into Silicon Valley and working at startups. And that kind of thing is realizing that if we can get these Fortune 500s to make their manufacturing processes, their products and packaging, the way that they treat their workers sustainable and ethical, if startups can come up with new innovations to some of the challenges that we face, whether it's, yeah, that new packaging or a better way of getting energy, a better way of storing energy, better ways of moving us around, any number of these things, then that is how you make the biggest impact. And guess what? It's an enormous opportunity for entrepreneurs and for corporates to get out there and do something about it and be really successful while they're at it. And I think that the companies that don't see this opportunity and miss this opportunity of the century are going to be the blockbusters and the Kodaks of the future that are going to fall away and become irrelevant, and they're going to die. And so we saw that with the digital revolution, that companies that didn't understand that things were going digital, many of them fell off. And then we got the, you know, Facebooks and Ubers and Googles and all these companies that grew like wildfire. And now we're going through a wave of a sustainability transformation where every little part of our global economy is being rebuilt to be sustainable. And so that means every part of the economy that you're working with has an opportunity to offer sustainable products and services and come at it from a sustainable position. And those markets are growing faster than conventional markets anyway. So it's a better business choice anyway.
So one question though that kind of comes to mind is, what do you do about companies that are not doing sustainability for sustainability's sake, you know, to actually draw down carbon, reduce their emissions, but because it's a market trend, because they see, oh, we can capture business via sustainability, and they actually aren't doing a whole lot to reduce emissions, you know, that big greenwashing sort of problem.
Yeah, I think there's kind of two questions there. One is, what do we do about companies that are greenwashing and they're not actually doing anything and having any impact? Those companies are sorely mistaken if they think that they can get away with that in the longer term. We live in a world of widespread social media. Any employee can out some process. It's becoming more and more transparent when companies are greenwashing. And so the power of people through social media is actually striking fear into the hearts of all of these corporations. And so so I think a lot of them have realized that this is a dangerous game to play. If you want to try to greenwash, you better back it up. And so what I'm seeing is that more and more companies are shifting from greenwashing to green hushing, which means that they're actually building these great sustainability programs. They're making a lot of progress, but they're afraid to talk about it. I've talked to some of the biggest companies in the world that we all know the names of, and they're working on some really great projects. And I said, oh, this is awesome. Are you going to put out a press release? Are you going to do a video or a story? And they're like, no way. Not until this is completely end of the line. We've got research behind it that backs it up. And even then, we might not talk about it, because even the accusation of being a greenwasher can damage our brand immensely, especially with Gen Z and millennials highly prioritizing sustainability and ethics and being super advanced with social media and spreading a message. that can destroy a brand that's been built for 100 years overnight. And so I think that's starting to really saturate the consciousness of companies. And so a lot of them are coming at it more in a more ethical way. And the other side of it is, what if they're just doing it and making the impact, but they don't actually care in their hearts? I think that's a win, right? I think everyone should care about the planet, obviously, our children, the future, the beautiful animals in nature that surround us. I think that's a huge value that we should all have. My goal is to convince people who don't care about that, that it's the right thing to do anyway. And I think if we get to that point, because I can't convince everyone to, you know, go camping and enjoy nature, right? And it shouldn't be my goal. It shouldn't be, you know, the goal that I take on in life. My goal is for us to transition to an economy of sustainable abundance. And if those companies are helping us get there without greenwashing, but they're making the changes because their customers are demanding it, because the governments are demanding it, and it's a hot topic, great, all the better, as long as they don't dump those programs as soon as, you know, the spotlight's off of them. And that, to me, is greenwashing.
I guess one of the I think it's tied in with what you're describing, this question of the greenwashing. I was intrigued by your discussion in the book about the difference between finite games and infinite games. And dear listener, this is kind of a switch to another conceptual framework, right? Everyone's heard of a zero-sum game where when I win, you lose, right? So if the winnings and losses always come out to zero, right? That's a way you can apply that kind of mentality to a lot of things. But you describe, Justin, the finite games and an infinite game as, and it seems to me the infinite game, if I remember correctly, is probably the kind of thing that would drive societal shifts and commercial shifts of companies by somehow playing this different kind of game. Can you describe what you meant by that and how it would apply?
Yeah, I think in short, the difference between a finite game and an infinite game is short-termism and long-termism, right? And so Simon Sinek has a great book about this. There's another one by James P. Carse, I think is his name. And it really goes into these details of, you know, when we think about, you know, think about a geopolitical conflict, think about Afghanistan, think about Vietnam, the people who lived in those countries are going to live there as long as they know, right? And they're defending their homeland. And so there's no end to the conflict, right? Their goal is to kick out the people who are coming to, in their minds, take over their country or occupy their country. whereas the opposing force that's coming in is trying to win a short-term game. There's an end to the game. There are well-defined sides, right? There's a good guy, there's a bad guy. And there's rules to this game that you play. And so this could be geopolitical, but it could also be business. And so a lot of businesses focus on this sort of the finite game of the quarterly report or the annual report, or are we winning this one market? We've got, you know, a runway of 2 years. If we don't win it, we're out. And in some cases that makes sense. So there are often many finite games within the larger infinite game, but the infinite game is something different depending on what you're talking about. For us as a civilization, it's to continue play. It's not to end the game. It's not to win the game. It's to continue the play of the game, which is civilization and society and continuing to build on the knowledge that we get to share with each other across the generations through great things like books. And so when we look at it from that perspective, it's more difficult for us to see others as enemies or to think about our competitions in terms of these short-term wins and externalize the costs and externalize the negative impacts and only take what we can gain from it. Because we realize that the reality of the situation is that we are playing some smaller finite games within a larger context. So I am a person dependent on my community, that's dependent on the economy, that's dependent on the ecology that surrounds it, that's dependent on the earth, you know, moving in the right direction, having a magnetic field, you know, the sun not shooting off incredibly large flares or getting hit by a comet. right? And so what is my stake in playing that infinite game? I think it's, hey, all of those things affect me. And so I should be playing so that we can continue the community, the society, the economy, the ecology, and all of that. And if I'm contributing to the destruction of a larger game that's outside of me, I won't survive anyway. And I think that's kind of the conundrum that we're up against as a species, is we've got this short-sighted view of, you know, stock market's doing this, the economy's doing that. Longer term, we know that climate change is happening, that disasters are becoming more frequent and more intense, and cities may flood within a generation or two. And that is a very fast change for a species like us that could wipe civilization off the map. And that is not an acceptable outcome, I think. Humanity is beautiful. We achieve incredible things. And if the sun is going to expand in 500 million years and melt the planet, there's no other species on the planet that would have the ability to continue consciousness from here to carry it out to the stars or other planets, or do something about continuation of consciousness and of life, which is such a beautiful thing that probably exists out there, but we don't know.
I think it's a fascinating juxtaposition, right? I mean, the infinite game, to success in the infinite game is to keep playing, right? I mean, that's just a simple, and that encapsulates so much about how we need to approach our operations. And yeah, so I think that is a, so tell me, does that, in your book, you cover a lot of ground. We touched on this before. I mean, there's questions about how to envision a future, but then there's basically almost like how to set up a business, how to run a business. And you move on to talk about like really large scale societal, as I was saying before, self-actualization for, and it's a great goal. I mean, you say, of course, that's what we want. We want every human being to be fully able to be human, right? And it may sound utopian, but I guess that's the point, right? That's what we're playing to. I mean, I presume that infinite game concept works into all of those other settings, right?
It does. I think it's a mindset that sets the foundation for how to think about that. And when I sat down to write the book and thought, like, how can I help people who want to make a positive change in the world? I've been privileged enough to be able to see inside some of these big companies, be at startups and see how they work, you know, see inside of governments, travel the world and get all this rich experience. And so how can I share some of these insights that I've been able to gain in a way that can help others to, you know, have a positive impact in the world? So the way I structured it was, one, let's think about the mindset here that we've talked about, right? Like, how do we shift from this doom and gloom and pessimism of, you know, the world's coming to an end and yeah, maybe I should just go move to Vegas and who cares, right? Not going to help anybody. So how do I shift that mindset to envisioning a better future? Two, what are all of the technological and sociological trends that are aligning to create these huge opportunities for entrepreneurs and for companies? And so if you want to be a part of it, not only can you, but it's a great option for your career. And then three, let's practice what we preach and do some design thinking around what might a society look like if we aligned it to Maslow's hierarchy of needs, not just for the individual, but for society. And what might it look like if we met the physiological, the community, the self-esteem and self-actualization needs of a society? And don't we want to live there? Why couldn't we? We have so much knowledge. We have so much technology that's exponentially advancing and much faster than I think people realize. All of the things with ChatGPT and AI are just moving so incredibly quickly and faster than we ever thought. I mean, going just as a short tangent, the last GPT moving to GPT-4, years ago, we thought that was going to take about 8 years to make that advancement. It happened in about 5 months.
Oh, wow.
This is moving very quickly. And so when these trends are happening with technology and with society, of course, it's going to always be used for bad. But the better way in my mind is like, one, sure, we need to protect against the bad. But let's envision the best way to leverage this. AI is an incredibly powerful tool and only getting more powerful for all people and accessible to anyone with a device and an internet connection, which is becoming closer to 100% of the human population. So how many people growing up in the, you know, outskirts of New Delhi or Nairobi or Detroit or, you know, San Diego or wherever, aren't reaching their full potential and that are the future Einsteins or LeBron James or Elon Musk's or Aretha Franklin's, right? Like there's so much potential in humanity that just gets squandered because people are just trying to survive day to day. And there's immense amounts of resources for everyone to share.
This is what I've enjoyed about the book, because we're talking about artificial intelligence and chatbot GPT, but I want to drag us back to the Renaissance for about 30 seconds. It turns out I am blessed to, I'm going to be going to Florence in May, Florence, Italy. So I'm watching YouTube stuff to figure out about, and this thing about the Renaissance and that the whole, those cities that we now treasure so much were consciously designed by the people in the Renaissance to be people oriented and to exemplify the highest human values in the architecture, right? And we still love these things today, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think it goes to the same kind of thing of the infinite game of, you know, the little YouTube video I was watching, of course, said that, you know, instead of looking at our junky cities with cars and skyscrapers and wishing that, oh, wouldn't it be nice to live in a medieval town, right? Let's build the cities that reflect our values today as part of, and now I would put on that as part of this infinite game where continuing the play is winning, right? And so it's a...
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what? That makes me think about this whole three dynamics model that I shared in the book too, right? That we're in a time of transition. So if you think about, you know, a first line going from top left to bottom right, that's kind of the old world. And there are things in the world today that are losing their fit for purpose. We know that they don't really work anymore and they're declining. There's another curve that's bottom left, top right, that is signs of that future. Like we're seeing little pieces of this, you know, utopian or wonderful future that we may live in that to someone in 100 years is going to sound normal. But to us, it sounds utopian. And then you've got a third curve that comes in the middle and peaks right between the two. And that's the innovation and the proliferation of trying to figure out solutions to make up for the loss of the old world and the beginning of the new. And that's this sort of battle space between the old world and the new, where we figure out how we transition from one to the other and where we move from one to the other. So to bring it back to your point, I think the Renaissance was focused on artistry. Individuals were out creating the most beautiful architecture or paintings or sculptures they could. And then we entered the industrial era and everything changed. And so then it was mass production. And so what's the most efficient, cost-effective way to produce things? Create them the same. Make it a pattern, right? Build buildings that look the same, you know, prefab for materials and things like that. And that's led to an incredible wealth of abundance for humanity. Granted, it had these second order climate impacts that we didn't think of, and we didn't know we could have such an impact on the climate, but we've pulled ourselves out of immense poverty that lasted for thousands of years into a world of incredible abundance for humanity, right? And in just a short century, century and a half, maybe, we have, you know, completely pulled ourselves from, you know, extremely high rates of child mortality to about 4%, right? From very little literacy to almost everyone can read, from zero vaccinations because they didn't exist and people died from things that we, you know, take NyQuil for now. And, you know, to being able to vaccinate against some of the scourges of our past. Violent conflicts, despite being all over the news, are actually down. Mm-hmm. Right. And interpersonal violence in general is actually down very far from the 90s. It's picking back up a little bit now, so I don't want to dismiss that. But there's all these great trends. So we're in transition. And so I think we're transitioning now away from a centralized industrial production society to one that is more distributed. And therefore, there can be more individuation and more artistry in all of those individual pieces. And we're seeing that with even big companies where they're personalizing your Nike shoe because they can just 3D print it, right? And all of these things that you do, it's all about, you know, how can you express yourself in an artistic way through these products and services and the buildings, but also the creations that you do. And those creations, a lot of times now, are digital. Look at TikTok, look at Instagram. So many people are creating such funny, intelligent, sometimes really benign and stupid, but entertaining, digital shorts, but also documentaries and also all kinds of other things that are basically zero marginal costs. Those are just bits and electrons instead of, tons and tons of concrete and physical.
You mean like a podcast?
Like a podcast. Yeah. It takes the same amount of energy for you to create this podcast for one listener as it does for a million. Right. And that's the zero marginal cost theory of how you then scale digital products. And if we include circular economy, we include sharing economy and all of that, we get to a world where it doesn't take five Earths for human beings to live in abundance, right? Because we can actually, instead of having our car sit in our driveway for 98% of its life, it can go out and either someone else can drive it, or it's an AI and it can just go pick people up and take them around and come pick you up when you need a ride to go somewhere. And then you've got a, shared kind of communally owned Uber or Lyft. And the communally owned thing is more about distributed autonomous organizations, smart contracts, where it's like a co-op when you go to a grocery store and the employees own the store. Are the employees happier or sadder when you go to those types of stores? Usually they're very helpful. They're happy to be there. They're partial business owners, and they think of themselves as enfranchised people who own a part of that. And I think we've gotten away from that in our centralized industrial society, taking people from farms where they all owned a piece of the land and they could, produce for themselves, right? And then we centralized everything, and now you just get a paycheck and everybody's, just working for wages. And now we're getting back to an ownership economy again, where people can own parts of startups, they can own parts of the community piece, they can own parts of digital products and services, and they're more empowered than ever to create, own, fund, and distribute all of the content.
Want to jump in on that. I mean, one thing that I often am sort of curious about, does all of this, or where does all of this fit in a capitalistic society that's based on success is based on gross domestic product? How much can you produce? How much can you sell? How much can you crank out there and get people to buy? Can those two, you just described a lot of utopic worlds, cannot align with our current capitalistic system?
Yeah. Some people even call that type of thing techno-communism, right? And that's, I don't think, what I'm advocating for. I think capitalism actually gets us there. It's just that capitalism needs an update. And so capitalism is very good at ratcheting down the costs and prices of things to make things cheaper and cheaper, and being able to ratchet up the amount of production that goes out. But what we've done is we've sort of shut people out of capitalism through centralized ownership and wageism. But through things like the Jobs Act, for example, and crowdfunding, it's easier than ever, one, for entrepreneurs to launch a new company that they own, and they can give people stock in that company so that the people they're working with also own part of the company and share in its growth and wealth. But also, because of the Jobs Act, I don't need to be a millionaire to invest in that anymore and to get some of those exponential returns. Now, this is not financial advice, and please be careful, because these are very risky investments. But this is where a lot of people's wealth comes from, is owning parts of a business. And sure, we see it in the stock market, but that's basically run by AIs and manipulated by, very professional stock traders, and people make money off of it. People still can retire. But as we've seen with SVB and some of the banking collapses, it's a sensitive system that, although resilient in a lot of ways, isn't guaranteed. And so we're seeing the rise of new economic and financial models that are happening through capitalism and are just distributing the ownership of capitalism back to the people that are helping to build it. And so I think we're instinctually and naturally pretty entrepreneurial species. We're very industrious. We're creative. Look at a playground full of kids and tell me people aren't creative and don't have energy, right? We basically just get it regimented out of us through life.
I'm three notes back. I mean, I'm ready to jump back. But let me just start where we are. That's why I had to
include so many things in the book, because there's just so many interesting concepts when you start, getting into all the trends and things going on.
You've probably read a book by a guy, I think his name is Thomas Piketty, right, about capital in the 21st century, okay? And it was this big economics thing. And he I don't want to, we won't go too long here, but I mean, he's basically saying that if part of his, I think what falls out of his argument is that if you have a green economy, circular economy, it is going to be low growth. And therefore, whatever your father did, you're going to do, much like the 1810s, where if your father was a farmer, you were going to be a farmer, right? And that was not a good aspect of sort of a circular economy, because you didn't have very many Mark Zuckerbergs walking around. But I think you're making the case here that the future of capitalism is lots and lots of small digital startups that have low cost to begin. So we're all going to go back to kind of the medieval Renaissance village again, right? Lots of small little businesses selling their wares. And that's a way around sort of the mega structure of capitalism. I think maybe that's complete horse hockey, but I mean, it just seems like an interesting connection to the kinds of things. I had never thought of the idea that, you know, the future of capitalism is a low capital startup kind of thing because of digital things, right?
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. We run the risk of techno-feudalism, right? And centralized power and all of that. That could happen. We shouldn't ignore it. But again, to the point we were making earlier, how do we build a society that doesn't go there? Let's not just fear it and, you know, and trash talk the big companies. Right. Let's go out and build a better alternative. And the good news is there's millions of people doing it, and it's never been easier to do that. And so I think that's part of it, is that we all get to share in the ownership of it, but also that the costs of living and the costs of interacting in the society and the economy start coming way down, right? I mean, when we talk about autonomous vehicles, for example, Baidu in China just surpassed 2 million rides in January for their driverless robo-taxi. There's no person in the driver's seat. And so 2 million people have taken these rides. Granted, China is a little more lax on the safety standards than the US, but it's just a question of when. And so then if your car or a car that's part of a, you know, Zipcar X club, let's say, or a Zipcar esque club that doesn't require a driver and requires less maintenance, and those costs are shared, then you aren't paying, you know, $15, $20 for a ride on Uber and Lyft because the driver is very expensive. You're paying 25 cents. And so the costs of going about your life are much cheaper. And a lot of the products you're consuming are digital. Now, there's a big question around housing. All of the really important stuff has gotten really expensive, and we need to solve that problem. Mm-hmm. While everything else has gotten really cheap, food, entertainment, digital, transportation starting to get there. In the meantime, especially in America, housing has gone up, education has gone up, and all these things that you kind of need to merge into a middle-class position in society have gotten outlandishly expensive. And I think we're seeing a correction right now to that. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. Let's take education. Do you need to pay $100,000 to go get a college education these days? I think it's still a good path to have a degree. But in more and more cases, there's free education available online that you can take to become a software programmer if you want, to learn some trades. And then you can go and get some hands-on training of trades. I think, you know, community college and technical schools should have a much higher level of respect availability in our country.
But interestingly enough, right here, up here in Massachusetts, we are facing that right now because, to your point, there's moves afoot to build lots and lots of wind turbines, to retrofit many houses. So you're going to need carpenters, you're going to need electricians, you know, orders of magnitude more than we have now, right? And so Where's the vocational training going to come from for these very good, very long-lasting careers? So, yeah.
Who's going to do it? And guess what? There's a lot of people just south of you guys who have been working in coal mines and are mad as hell that those coal mines are getting shut down. Yeah. Yeah. But there's companies out there. Edlin Renewables is one that I just talked to recently. I'm sure there's a ton of them that are building programs where they go out and put in solar into coal country and retrain the workers that used to work in the coal mines to now have a route into the new economy.
Absolutely.
And this is what we should be doing. This shouldn't be a politicized issue where we're saying, you know, this represents me and my culture, and Black Lung is something that I want to, you know, pass along to my children. right? Yeah. Like, no disrespect to coal workers. It's a really hard job, and they've done a lot of work to support this country. And coal has been the backbone of energy for America, still is for China and a lot of places. But we're finding better ways of fueling the country. And that transition is one of opportunity for those people. And so we need them to, you know, put out solar panels and wind turbines and manage the energy and do the construction. And that's a great job for a lot of people.
It's interesting. I mean, I have these sort of go-to little sayings, and I, you're making me rethink some of them. One of them is the famous Ursula Le Guin quote about how if you tried to explain capitalism to a medieval serf, I don't know why we're on medieval the medieval times tonight, but I mean, if you try to explain capitalism to someone from the year 1000, they would not know what the heck you were talking about, right? And I've maintained that we're facing a thing now that we are, the future is going to be just totally different than what we know. And it's hard to understand. But I think the case you're making is that we need to envision it. We need to actively be thinking about what the insanely different system that actually enhances human happiness is and start trying to build that. Isn't that fair?
Yeah, especially with that as the goal. I think especially in the tech sector, a lot of times it's technology for technology's sake. And we say like, hey, I'm an engineer. I built this really cool thing, and now I've got a solution looking for a problem. And I think that's the wrong direction to go. The direction you're going, I think, is the right way, where it's, what are our goals? Let's use design thinking here to start with, what is the most desirable outcome? And it's that people are empowered, people are safe, people have the ability to actualize themselves and do what they want to do in society, as long as they're respecting other people. And how do we get there? Okay, now we can kind of look back at where are we today and what's the gap between the two? Mm-hmm. And now why? What are the problems that are stopping us from getting from here to there? And now what am I good at? What do I enjoy doing? You know, what's my sort of Venn diagram of what I can offer the world, what the world needs, and what I can get paid to do? And how can I, you know, lay my hands on that that path and help build a little piece of it for everybody, including myself? And, you know, and that's the role that we can help. And I think it's a lot more meaningful life to live, and it's a lot more fun. You meet a lot of interesting people, and things are changing so quickly that I think it's important for us to not get wrapped up in which technology is going to get us there or have an attachment to exactly how it's going to work out or exactly what it's going to look like. Because to your point, we don't know. Everything's going to change. And everything is already changing very rapidly. And so as long as we're committed to that goal and we're starting along the path, we'll iterate and we'll, you know, rapidly prototype and we'll get our way there. But if all we can think of is killer robots and, you know, AI putting spikes into our spines and, you know, forcing us in the matrix,
right.
That may not be what we get, but we're not getting much better.
Wow. So this has been fascinating. Justin, tell me, give us the name of the book again, and where can people find it if they want to? Tell me more. Where should people go looking for it?
Yeah, sure. Thank you. This is the pop quiz, because the subtitle is actually the long, hard problem here. But it's called What Could Go Right? Envisioning or Designing Our Ideal Future to Emerge from Continual Crises to a Thriving World. By Justin Bean. And so you can find it on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your local business or your local bookstore. And yeah.
That's great. What we'll do is, what I will do is put up links on the show page to that, so people can go find it and read it. It's intriguing concepts. There's lots of, and I would say everyone will be able to find something in it that interests them. If the show page is going to be on the MCAN website, that's massclimateaction.org. You look across the top, it says there's a banner, it says newsletter and more. You pull that down and find blog and podcasts. So hidden away in there is the show page with the hot links on it. If you have any comments or questions about the show, please send us an email to podcast@massclimateaction.net. Let us know what we should be talking about. You can listen to us on your smartphone using any of the modern podcast distribution apps. Please ask all of your friends to listen to us on their favorite modern podcast distribution app. And while you're in there, rank us. Say how great we are. We want to thank our good friend D.R. Tucker for his continuing research support. Week after week, he sends us great new ideas of things that we should be discussing. Thank you so much, D.R. So we want to close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we have to insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade, or actually over the next 7 years, under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon that respects environmental justice communities. And I should say, a future that is planned, is thought about. Someone envisions it. Yeah, that's a nice way. Anyway, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Always a pleasure.
Justin, thank you for taking the time to chat. It's been great.
Ted, Mariah, thank you so much for having me. It's been a really fun chat.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.